about the nature of adult education, both from a European perspective, or the word pakeha is used for European people, then to look at the actual players in the particular relationship I'm talking about, and eventually through to ACE funding, ACE standing for Adult and Community Education, which is a key factor in this little scenario, and then what are the issues and threats. Some of the issues and threats we already have discussed in this conference so far. All right, this is where I need some sort of stick or whatever. Some of you may know of the geography of Aotearoa New Zealand. I use the phrase Aotearoa New Zealand quite deliberately. Those people who want to emphasise the bicultural nature of New Zealand use that phrase rather than the phrase New Zealand. So it's a kind of political stance. All right, the area that I'm talking about is up there in Hamilton. Can you see it on the map? Okay, you see Auckland up the quite near the top, which sees itself as the major city in New Zealand. In fact, it is, because it's about 1.3 million, mainly new immigrants tend to go through Auckland. And Wellington being the capital city, Christchurch is where the recent earthquakes have occurred and is fairly a devastated city at this moment. And then Dunedin is where the Scots people went, right, and reinvented Scotland and New Zealand. So if you want no change when you go to New Zealand, just go to Dunedin. Now Hamilton is 80 miles south of Auckland, has a population around about 150,000. It's a place where I grew up and went to school, that kind of thing, and then took off and did other things. But that's where the University of Waikato was based. So that's a little bit of geography. In terms of universities, there are 8 public universities. There are 22 or 23 polytechs or institutes of technology. There are over 800 private training establishments, and there are 3 what are called whare wānanga, which basically means a Māori tertiary institution. So that's the landscape of what's called tertiary education in New Zealand. We use the phrase higher education for universities. I was going to ask you questions, actually. Name any facts that you know about New Zealand. Where you go? Quickly. Had an earthquake. Right. Okay, it looks a little bit. Right, yes, in fact, there were some advertisements on television which have pictures of the streets expected in New Zealand making comparisons. Yeah. All right, anything else?
Is it true that the local brewery in Dunedin is called Spates?
Yes.
Okay, I just want to check.
That's an interesting fact which I hadn't considered. All right, anything else? Well, obviously, indigenous people are known as Māori people. So let's move on to have a look at some of these facts, which I think are reasonably important. The small population means it's a very immediate kind of society. People tend to know other people fairly immediately. Colonised by Britain, hence most of our institutions are of British origin, like as we'll see in education, the Workers Education Association, Mechanics Institute, those kind of things. Which started off. The next point I think is particularly important around the ethnic diversity, which is increasing presently. Bulk of the people are still European. The Māori are around about 15%, depending on how you define Māori, because of self-definition and there are other definitions, but let's say for the moment it's 15%. Pacifica, people from the South Pacific, around about 12%, and Asian around about 5%. If you lived in Auckland, probably the Asian population would be about 15 to 20%, so it varies from place to place. Auckland the Magnet, I've already mentioned that. In terms of the establishment of New Zealand as a society, egalitarian principles were put up there as being really important. We were going to have a society that was not going to be stratified, right? None of that stuff imported from the UK. Of course, it's every society is stratified, so that didn't quite work. But the principle was there. Political stability, despite the fact that we have a mixed member proportional parliament these days, I think it is a reasonably stable government. There's an election coming up actually in about 3 months' time, just immediately after the Rugby World Cup. And that will be interesting because there are fringe parties on the left and the right which hold quite a lot of sway. They get 15% of the vote, they can actually alter things quite considerably, such as the Greens or the Māori Party. Strong social justice ethic. Go back to women's suffrage. New Zealand's first place to have women's suffrage in the world. So we like to think that those kind of enterprises, we'll call them that, are really important. The next point around the treaty comes through in this presentation. The treaty, signed way back in 1940, has quite a lot of relevance these days because it's integrated into policy wherever you look. And particularly the notions of protection, as in protection of the tāma or the language, partnership with both Pākehā and Māori working together, and participation in trying to encourage the participation of the race of Māori in mainstream education and their own alternative system. And then there's the question of whether or not New Zealand is a bicultural country or a multicultural. It is officially bicultural, and it is certainly multicultural as well. All right, the broader context, I think we've already talked about this quite a lot in this particular conference around neoliberalism. You had Thatcherism in the UK, we had Roger Nomics, and Roger Nomics, I think, was even more savage than Thatcherism, because New Zealand, being a smaller society, when you affect change, it happens quickly. Right? It's not the same kind of huge history and bureaucracy around. And so those features of neoliberalism, I think we've seen before. I guess the significant couple there are around privatisation in education. I mentioned before about over 800 private training establishments in languages and all sorts of areas. The cult of efficiency, which is sort of a motif going right through New Zealand society. And just as I left, there had recently been another budget, and the public service was about to get sliced further. So many of the things that we have in this country. All right, colonisation has had an effect. This is talking about the European side of things. I realise my time's limited, so I'm going to skip over some of the features. The second point there is a guy called Robert Tobias, one of my colleagues, way back in 96, tried to depict what adult education looked like in the country, and you can see those areas of adult basic education, so-called second chance education, personal development, cultural education, community development, that kind of captured the lot, really. I don't think that configuration has changed much since then. Then I think there was quite a lot of Kiwi culture beginning to percolate through into the different forms of education, particularly in the areas of parent education and rural development. Anyone know what RIPS stands for? Special prize here. I'd be actually astonished if you did. Rural Education Activity Programs. It was a program set up in small towns where basically adult educators, amongst others, were inserted in the town as catalysts, and they basically drew upon the resources of government and of other providers. So, and still, after the budget, they are still in existence, to my amazement. So that is really one of the innovations that we've had. These things here are particularly significant in terms of this particular presentation. There are two sets of funding criteria I'm about to show you. This is of adult and community education in general. So it applies, if you're getting funding from government, these are the three things that you should be looking at and make sure that your programs reflect. And you'll notice that strengthening social cohesion is one of those. And this is important when I get later in the presentation. And because most of my research has been in older adult education, I had to mention that about the UNRIA movement. Right, now Māori adult and community education. Māori is an old tradition, primarily. Right, so it's not as well documented. There have been some prominent figures, people who have been champions of Māori adult education. Ranganui Walkie's at the University of Auckland. And you wouldn't guess that the two Smiths there That's Linda Tuawai and Graham Inamalaro Smith, were actually Maori, who took up their middle names, just like conventional European names. However, they've both been very prominent in First Nations education, and Graham Smith in particular has worked with the Canadian government and UBC and other places on Indigenous education. There's a whole different ethos that's been brought in. Kaupapa Māori is like a philosophical framework within which most Māori education has been designed, and it's akin to, if you really analyse it, to a Freirean perspective. Now, education in the Māori sense is reflective of a whole lots of different things there, including the ancestral canoes are significant in terms of where people came from Hawaiki originally to New Zealand. If they landed in a particular place, that became their kind of territory and iwi associated with particular geographical zones. And then the whole social structure of Māori society is based around the ancestral canoe and the tribes that adhere to that. Now, there are other factors which I don't believe I'm going to have a lot of time to go into, but there is like gender differentiation in traditional Māori society that is very gender specific as to who does what. Now, of course, being a Māori feminist is quite a difficult thing. It's almost a contradiction, but there have been some Māori women who have forced a change in some of the protocols when it comes to being on marae, which are public spaces where people are invited on as guests and so on. And men typically do the whaikorero or the talking, and the women are doing the work behind the scenes. You can imagine to some feminists that is not a very good recipe. I think of the other things here, two things I want to emphasise: the collectivist orientation of Māori society, unlike I think what we've been talking about here, in terms of it seems to be a much more individualistic kind of society, and the high status of elders, who are called kumātua in the Māori society. Of course, this has been challenged in the urban areas. So the players here, now this is the Centre for Continuing Education, which I have responsibility for, which is a really much smaller version of what it used to be. And originally the University of Auckland was like the bigger institution. Waikato established its identity and strength in the 1960s. I think another thing to say here, if you look in the next couple of points, I worked in continuing education in Waikato previously in the 1980s, and those were the heyday of adult education in New Zealand. You name it, we could do it. And I showed you that region before. We had masses of programs all over that region. And part of my job, which I couldn't believe that I was doing, was going out and talking to people in the community about their needs and aspirations and designing programs in their own backyards. Of course, all that was just, virtually all of that has disappeared. Not all of it, but most of it. And so the innovative areas of Māori education, women's studies, trade union education, those things that are on the margins, were brought into the institution through continuing education. And there was a certificate in Māori studies, which we had developed, and I actually survived that program, managed to get through it, more because of my academic skills than my Māori language ability. That was, I think, a really significant program. Now, the Ro'aua'awa Trust itself, it's a holistic kind of environment where education is one of many different domains. The important thing here is that it's in an urban context. The focus is on older people. If you look at anywhere else, both within Māori society and elsewhere, youth is all important, so the resources are going to youth education. So this is an aberration in that sense. And you can see there are all sorts of different activities which are involved in this program that is run on the site in Hamilton in an urban area. So of course Māori language being really part of Māori Renaissance, and other things which are important to Māori society, but not necessarily important to the university, and this is where the rub comes. Here you see a Māori woman who was working with two students from a local high school, you see the doing kete, doing using flax and so on to make things. And that's what they end up looking like, some of the things that they have a small shop where they sell some of the products that are produced. Some of these are magnificent specimens. Anyway, so the relationship was formalised before I took over, when I happened to come back to New Zealand after being here for 4 years. And it's really an Indigenous program based in a mainstream Pākehā setup, which is a little bit unusual. And you can see the things that the university is responsible for and the things that the trust is responsible for. A point of contention is this one here. The teachers come from within the group itself, or within the wider iwi. So what we're really doing here is capacity building. However, there is also within the university a School of Māori Pacific Development who see this, don't see the, this program in quite that way. They feel that they should be teaching this program and not someone, if you like, from within the own group. So this is one of the points of contention that I'm having to deal with when I get back. Right, so there's been a reduction of funding to adult and community education by government. So this program has been reduced in terms of the extent of the funding from previous years. It's still going. Now, these here are the official priorities for universities in terms of what ACE funding should go to. So the big question for me, the major issue, is how does this program, which is geared at Komatua, fit within this kind of regime, which is, you might suspect, the kind of things from the university research inform, university research, the reflective citizen, the informed citizen. I mean, these are all important things. Pathways through and into the university, and capacity building. I might be able to make an argument there, but there's not a comfortable fit for me and for some other people of the trust program with those priorities. There is a possibility that priorities may change, and I hope that I'll be part of that renegotiation if there is that. So to finish up, some of the sort of issues and threats, I think, here. There is that tension between the two groups, the sets of priorities that I showed you, the more general ones for adult and community education, and those much more specific to a university. The curriculum is heavily orientated to a kaupapa Māori ideology. That's not necessarily a problem for me, but for some other people it may well be. The teachers coming from the Komatua themselves, and are they really properly qualified teachers? You know, do they have master's degrees or PhDs, apparently? Well, the answer is no. Peer learning. This is a collaborative-based program when basically competition is what really matters between universities and even within them. And is the government going to continue to support, first of all, adult and community education, and therefore this program? Now, I was surprised that we just had a recent budget and, in fact, we were left alone. The previous year, 46% cuts, and I was all for being geared up that we were going to be wiped off the face of the earth. But they've left us alone for the moment. And here's the, aside from adults and community education, if you ask what are the main priorities of government, the TEC is the Tertiary Education Commission, the funder of universities and polytechs and so on. These are the major priorities: under 25s, Māori and Pacifica. Now you would think that because we have Māori here, that the program would be safe, but I'm not betting on it. I think what they're really looking at is both these together. If someone is under 25 and Māori, then that's where the priorities, one of the major priorities will be, alongside Pacifica students. So anyway, that's a little bit of, a taster of what's going on in adult and community education in Aotearoa New Zealand and in the University of Waikato in particular, and the particular relationship between the trust and the university.
Thanks very much. Well, what a tour de force. In 20 minutes, quite rightly recognised our ignorance at the beginning, set the scene in terms of New Zealand, then give us a bit of a further context, then looking at the things that related to us, then looking at the work that I have with this trust, which was completely new to me, and then I think focusing finally on this partnership between the university and the board of government. So fascinating, thank you. Now I'll open it up to the floor for questions.
Thank you. I've changed my mind about not coming to New Zealand by now. I'll try and negotiate with you later. I think there are two areas of interest for me. I've worked in the UK in Lancaster University doing similar programs with the Pakistani community. And of course now I'm in Lesotho, which is an African country with black Africans as the 99% of the population. And there were many similarities in the culture with the culture that I'm in at the moment. I thought the end bit was interesting, the issues and threats. It just took me straight back to Lancaster University in the 1990s when I was working with these communities and we were doing these projects and recruiting local people, all the same kind of thing, and all the same issues. And the way we got away with it in the end was to create it, turn it into an actual research project. And as soon as it became a research project, we were allowed to do it. And that enabled us to keep going for a few more years. So that would be my response to those issues. But it's interesting that nothing changes, really.
Thank you. Is the funding coming through from the government, through the university, to this initiative? Was it going directly to the initiative itself?
It's going via, it comes to the university, right. then to us.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think the university would readily disrupt that arrangement, but there are some people within the university who are, you know, they're looking for resources, they're looking for anywhere they can find it, and this looks like right pickings, to be frank. So we have the relationship with the School of Environment Research and Development is a fairly fraught one, and the school itself is in some jeopardy. I mean, financially, it's costing the university a lot of money. So they're looking for whatever ways that they can actually actively, you know, get more students, so I can understand where they're coming from. What I'm trying to do is protect this program.
I've got a question which may fall completely flat because it's based on a fact that I may know that they need. Am I right in thinking the higher education system doesn't have entry requirements? By and large, but that's changing.
Yeah, that is a major factor. Where the universities have brought in what they call managed entry. And that basically, the other thing is that there's a ceiling on a number of places in universities. So at the moment, there's more demand than there is supply. So there's lots of students out there trying to get into university. And the college that I was brought back, I went back to, or started really, was based on bringing students into the university, preparing them for university. And one thing that happened, for example, we had a certificate in university preparation, a massively successful program, which the university said, we're going to take that resource that goes into that program and redistribute that resource to the faculties. So we had to find ways of trying to of getting that program to survive. The solution was actually an articulation arrangement with the local polytech, such that we continue with virtually the same program on our campus, same teachers, same curriculum, but the actual EFS, or the funding, goes to the polytech. That's a somewhat unusual piece of cooperation between two rival institutions in the city. So, and it's a relationship I think has been really positive and we want to continue. But had that not happened, that program I think would have just disappeared. The whole thrust there is I think it's really saying that universities should not be involved in this sort of pre-degree work. That is really the roles of other institutions. As part of this differentiation that's been talked about in the sector. So there's a hardening, I think, in terms of what a university is and what a polytech is. And the college that I'm part of is in that cusp. And so you're sort of fighting battles the whole time to try to hold on to what you have.
And so an associated question, in terms of adult learning at university, is the kind of the combination of this
I need to answer your question more specifically. Yes, there used to be open entry, but the managed entry means that it was no longer the case. And one of the ways of older students coming in was actually through that program I just mentioned. It's like a side door. If they come through that program and achieve a B average, they're guaranteed a place within the faculties. So that is one little victory. But I think we will see the numbers of mature age students declining in New Zealand. Historically, it's been fairly open, as you've observed, and I think that's not going to be the case much longer.
Are we allies within the university? Against some of those issues we talked about?
I wish I could say we're a lot. Actually, one thing has happened since I've left in 3 weeks. The dean of the faculty, who's supportive, has now become the deputy vice chancellor. So occupies a position of considerably more power. And I think as long as I can keep on his side, we'll have an ally there.
Yeah. I only say that because, from personal experience, I think it was a long time before I realised how important it was about the way in which that institution was led and the values that were inherent in that. And it sounds a bit odd, but actually that seems to be more important than a lot of things in terms of enabling you to live those values within the institution. Okay, yeah. Thanks. Right. That's fantastic. I'd like to show you appreciation for that. Okay, we move over now to John and Anna Adika, who will be doing a presentation on why they participated to international collaboration. But I know you've got quite a novel way of presenting and doing this, so we'll change over the presentations and move on.
What we're going to try and do while Annika's doing the technology is we're going to try and have a conversation about work we've been doing together. And have the conversation in front of you, and you can interrupt or take part in the conversation. So we've kind of divided it up, because when there's two, there's always quite difficult to divide each other to do, you know, good bits, and we're not saying all that, you know. So what we thought we'd do is have a conversation about some work we've been doing this year, because we've been collaborating on a piece of work together, and we are rich with experiential learning, I think. But like experiential learning, it's all up here in our heads, and it's also, you know, part of the kind of practice we shared in the last year ago or so. And I think part of today is you helping us to kind of work through some of that experiential learning and think a bit more clearly about things. Because often when you're involved in action, you don't get enough time to stand back from it and reflect upon it. So in a sense, we're using you as a kind of reflection group to help us to think about some of the issues this has thrown up for us in our collaboration. So Annika, do you want to introduce me and I'll introduce you? We're going to reverse introduction. It's all part of this experiment.
So, this is this man here, I can tell you. Here is Mr. John's forum,
and he's a
professor, and it sounds very impressive.
Till you get to know me.
But he says that's nothing to get impressive about. I got to know John when I was here in, we were a group of 10 people from Sweden coming to England and Northern Ireland on a study visit, 2007 I think it was. And John had set up the study visit, and it was very, very interesting for us. And it was of course about widening participation. And he turned out to be a very nice person.
You know that's not true, but you know that.
And I got to know John very much Now we have been working together this last year, since April last year, and building a program in vital participation at my University of Borås.
So this is Annika, Annika Mann. Annika is a lecturer at the University of Borås. Hands up anyone that knows where Borås is.
I told you.
Oh, see, I know, he's right. He's right. So, hands up who knows where Gothenburg is. Okay, all right, right. So, if you imagine where Gothenburg is, Borås is east. Southeast?
Southeast.
Southeast.
From Gothenburg, yes.
Gothenburg. So if you... If you drive out of Gothenburg to the southeast after about an hour or so, depends how fast you drive, you'll come to Borås, and there is a university college in Borås where Annika works. One of the things I've learned about Borås, because I've been working there quite a lot this year, is that the region is characterised by a large amount of textile manufacture, and so as often is the case with universities who have a regional identity, that's reflected in both the aspirations and work opportunities of students from the region, and also to some extent in the curriculum of the university. So there is a great deal of emphasis and great deal of expertise on textile design, textile research, materials design, research and so on and so forth, which reflects the region within which Borås sits. There are two other universities in the region, Chalmers University is a private university, and a private university.
Swedish, yeah.
Oh, yeah, oh, sorry. I'll tell you in Swedish later. I don't speak Swedish.
Private, yeah.
And there's Gothenburg University. So there's a number of universities within the region which has an effect, I think, on Borås as an institution and indeed the learners that it serves. Annika's job within the university is to coordinate widening participation and access work across the university, and that's how we came together. So a common interest in access and widening participation in two different contexts, in two different countries, actually brought us together, which I think is a starting point for our collaboration.
Okay.
Shall I?
Nice.
Okay. So what we want to talk to you about in the next 15 minutes or so quite ambitious, or you have to talk very quickly and you have to listen very quickly, really is a piece of work we've been doing this year, which turned out to be, but didn't start off as about challenge and change. When we sat down a year ago and decided, you know, what we wanted to do, we didn't talk the word challenge or change, did we? Okay. But as we got more involved in some of the work, we realised that actually a precondition for doing the things we thought needed to be done, working with colleagues and so on, was that challenge needed to be had and change needed to happen. They were preconditions, therefore, of some of the things that the university thought it needed to do, and and also the things that the staff we were working with, because we worked with a lot of staff during this year, started to identify in our various conversations with them. So really, we embarked upon something we didn't know we was doing until really quite a long way into the process. We embarked upon a process of institutional change, or helping to assist institutional change, and in the process challenging the university, and the university challenging itself in different ways that it was working in order to kind of fulfil the terms of the piece of work we was doing. I think between our two institutions we had shared aspirations. I won't talk about University of East London, there are colleagues here that know it, so we don't have time to go into all the context, but there are lots of shared aspirations and characteristics between the two institutions, which I think also helped our collaboration to work in ways that it might not have done otherwise. We had a mission which was regional in focus and had a commitment to widening participation. We had, as I say already, regional characteristics and a regional focus. Borås much more in terms of its textile industry, UEL, really at the centre of a big economic regeneration part of East London and South East England as well. So there were similarities there, I think, in terms of what kind of institutions we were and where our prime focus of work was. And there's two bits to the work we've done. We've finished the first phase of work, which has been this year, which we're going to talk to you briefly about now, and we're just embarking and beginning to plan the work for next year.
Yeah.
Oh, right. That's very good. Okay. Annika?
Was it?
Can you talk about this one?
Oh, I think, let's go back. Did you talk about that?
We did.
Okay.
Next one?
Which?
Did you ask me about that?
No, it's you.
Okay, it's me. Yes. See, conversation, good partnership.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that we recognise that widening participation involves is it involves institutions setting challenges. And I think one of the things that Annika and I discovered about Baroff's as an institution was that the aspirations it had were somewhat removed and disconnected in some ways from the reality within inside the institution. And so what we were concentrating on and our efforts on was trying to identify, working with across the university group, what things we could effect change, what things we could help them to think about and look at in this process of challenge or change. And so we had a number of workshop sessions where we collectively looked at different aspects of the way the university is operating and asked them those hard questions about how did these ways of working contribute or pose a barrier to different aspects of widening participation. One of the things we noticed in all of this is that our experience nationally and both in terms of institutions have varied. I mean, Sweden and the UK some years ago, certainly in the last 10 years, had a lot of convergence in terms of its policy. We had, for example, the same participation target, 50% by year 2010. And then the Social Democratic government in Sweden was voted out. Conservative-led coalition was voted in. That participation went, and responsibility for widening participation moved very sharply to individual institutions rather than having a government policy. Familiar in the UK now, I think, because now we're seeing a not dissimilar pattern in terms of where the responsibility for widening participation lies. It will lie, as we found out from the white paper yesterday, in England, certainly, much more with universities, less with government policy and government departments. So we've seen, as a backdrop to our work, this convergence-divergence process working nationally, and I think that also is taking place in the practices of individuals within institutions, and it's reflected, I think, in some of the work we've been doing with colleagues. Two emphases in our work. One was to develop an institutional approach. So we weren't about trying to change students or learners. Often widening participation, either explicitly or tacitly, actually is about trying to change learners in some kind of way. Make them different learners, prepare them different, make them aware of various things. All can be very useful approaches. But often the key things that need to happen in order to facilitate opportunities are actually around changing institutions in certain ways. And that's, in some ways, a harder thing to do if you're within an institution. Because sometimes it's very difficult to understand what's going on. Why aren't we making progress? We're all for widening participation, but actually not much is happening. And it's the not much is happening bit which was really the start of the work we were trying to do over this last year. And in order to do that, and to produce something at the end which was useful for the university, we had to have a kind of strategic objective, which was to make a plan for the university, but which was rooted in the ownership and the values that it aspired to in terms of widening participation and active strategy.
So I will talk a little bit about what we have been doing then as a case study. And the University of Borås has often called themselves the University of Diversity. And when we look into that, we don't know why. We don't know why. We haven't done anything to you know, make this reputation. So it's partly, probably from the demographic in the area that we have. Similar to you, really, in the east of London kind of students. But we have, we show up really fine, you know, good statistics, good figures every year when we send it to our agency of higher education. So we can divide our student groups in students from working homes and ethnic backgrounds and so on. But we don't do anything about it, as John said. So this was the beginning of this project, really, to build up a strong platform. And it was the strength of that, I think, is that our management of the university really wants this. I was very, you know, talked to them a lot that we had to do something, and they were, you know, on the track with me, so it was very good. And we have been working with us, Lena Nordholm as VC, and Björn Broström, he is the pro VC, but now he's going into being the VC. So it's very good. They really support this, and it's very important, I think, for a university as an institution, that they must have the support, and the cross-university support as well. So the overall aim for this project was to identify development for wine participation and to make it an issue that was important for everyone working at the university. Because I could hear in the beginning of 2000, we were talking about this topic a lot, as John told us, when we had another government, it was more of a topic at universities that we have to do this, but now it has been, you know, no one talks about it anymore. And they said, oh, well, we don't need that. So that was really an important question for me and for the university to make this well known so we could do something, really. So, we wanted to build this capacity and ownership at the whole university, so I tried to get hold of persons all over the cross university, persons that were willing to come into a group, a development group, together with John and me, for 1 year, so we could just work together and discuss what is this really, what is it, what does it mean for us. How should we go on talking? We must identify what are we really doing and what do we want to do? You must excuse my Swedish English, so I hope you understand. Yeah, that's good. So we had workshops, as John told you a little bit about. We had four workshops. So we built an advisory group of 12 persons across the university. We have 6 schools, and there was one person from every school, and then it was from administration and from the library learning resources and so on. So we have built a really good group to work with us, and then we had another persons from the university that was interested. So we had about 25, I think, working in the workshops. Different themes. The first theme we had was meanings, definitions, and implications. And it was very, very good to start with that, because everyone in this group had different meaning of what it meant.
Yeah.
So it was very, very, we had many discussions about this. What is it really? What does it mean for us at the university? And the second time we were talking about pre-entry and higher education access. And it appeared that many of those that were in the group, they didn't even know what the other ones were doing, really. So I think that's a problem for every university, really, that we don't know what we're doing in the other schools and institutions, really. So that was very, very good for us to explore what are we doing really. We do a lot of things that's very good. And the next workshop was developing action projects such as math support. I know that you'll be talking about that. we had this portfolio day, as we had this textile, school of textiles. I wanted to start a day where you can invite students from schools in the community to come and see what is it. Could I show my thoughts about this design and, you know, clothing and so on. And we have academic writing, as many people have, and project for students mentoring children out in the community schools. So we were having many discussions, and this was to find this challenge, what should we really do now? How could we do it, and how could we make this known at the whole university? The wider participation should be something that you were talking about, that we want these students. Many teachers say, no, it's so much trouble, they need so much support, and it's so much trouble, we don't want them. So that was the main topic, to challenge and change this at university, really.
Okay. So just to emphasize one of the things that came out of what Annika's just said, I think one of the things we discovered very quickly was that although we were working in an institution where the senior managers, indeed a number of the staff, professed that they were a university which was diverse, a university which was committed to widening participation, what actually we found was a whole set of barriers to that, those ambitions being fulfilled. So in other words, there's a kind of mismatch of thinking and wanting to be something and actually where you were as an institution and the way you organised and acted and worked. And that was a kind of, I think, it seems a kind of obvious thing, but sometimes you need to get into a self-challenge mode in order to recognise that. Because that's not an easy thing for an institution to recognise in itself. Because institutions tend to do what they do, which is institutionalise the people that work in them. So you see this as normal. And so you have a rhetoric of access and widening participation, but actually, when you look at what happens, it can be the contrary. So I think part of the thing that Annika's describing was a first step, which actually you need to say, you don't know what you don't know here, really. You know, there are things here which, you know, are actually at odds with what you're professing to do. And that's not an easy conversation to be had in a university. So I think great credit to the staff and, I think, to the senior managers who were prepared to enter that discussion. I know so many universities wouldn't even have that conversation with themselves, although they continue to write in their prospectuses all kinds of things about widening participation work. But actually, when you look at their behaviour, the way the institution works, it works to the opposite of those things. So I think it was very brave of this university to take a mirror to itself and say, what do we really do? We know what we say about what we do, but actually, what do we do? And how can we bring align what we want to be and we say we want to be with the way we operate in all different aspects of our work, in our partnerships, in our collaboration, in the way we organise ourselves, in the way we teach, learn, assess, all those things which actually are about serving different learners in different ways and becoming the professed objective, which is a university diversity. What does that actually mean in practice to be that? And I think... What? I think we're here. Yeah, you're so cut up. Sometimes I get a bit carried away. You know, I can't help it.
This is just examples of what we're doing.
Exactly. So I think all those things are really important. Some of the things that we have got to so far, we produced with the group what we call a toolkit. A toolkit is a nice neutral thing. Well, it's not a neutral thing, but it's something that doesn't threaten people. It sounds like kind of activity. Actually, what it was a way for people to self-assess their practice against these aspirations that they profess to have and then begin to think, what do we need to do in order to progress in that direction, which is the direction we want to go in as an institution? So actually, this was about a value exercise, coming to terms with the kind of values that an institution want, and then trying to figure out how you get there and what you need to do, how you need to change and challenge yourself in different ways in order to do that. I think institutions, particularly the ways different subject tribes operate, can be very different one from another. Annika mentioned colleagues in the fashion design area who discovered that through looking at the way they admitted their students, actually they were excluding lots of students, simply because students in schools didn't know how to put forward a portfolio in order to get admitted to the university. They didn't know what a portfolio was. Why would they? They didn't know anyone worked in the fashion industry. So one of the things that they went on to do was to have a day with schools where no one came from those schools to the university to say, look, this is what a portfolio is, this is what a good one looks like, these are the things that should be in. Very obvious thing to do, but it wasn't something they were aware they needed to do in order to open up that department to a broader community in that region. So these are very practical things, as well as having the aspirations, kind of aligning your behaviour practice in line with your objectives and values for wider participation. So we had a number of examples in different subject areas where colleagues actually rethought their strategies for admissions, for example, or rethought their strategies for gathering information and data in ways which brought them much more in line with their professed values. Okay. And eventually, these are the things we ended up with. We ended up with a whole range of partnerships across the university, so people began to work across disciplines rather in the silos that they were working in before. So the librarians had started having relationships, not those kind of relationships, but you know, organisational relationships with different academic groups, which they never had before. But widening participation challenged them to have those relationships in order to work with schools, share information, provide advice and guidance to parents and so on. They needed to have them in order to do that. Whereas before, it was kind of silo. Some people did it well, other people didn't do it at all. The library did its own thing, and so on and so forth. So that it actually brought this notion of organisational change together. We had a theoretical model which we pinched from Gorard, who pinched it from someone else. I think it might have been Basil Bernstein, but my sociology of education doesn't go back that far. But what we tried to do was to think about a kind of theoretical model which would help us understand some of these things that we were working in, to help us stand back a little bit. And I guess one of the areas, I mean, Gorard talks about three areas widening participation. He talks about situational, dispositional, and he talks about institutional aspects of widening participation work. And I guess what we focused on was really this thing, the institutional part of what he describes. And rather than kind of the inflexible provision, which we did find examples of, and which people did look at and change in many respects, I think one of the things I came away with was better understanding the kind of organisational barriers that there are to doing these things, that are often invisible to people, but they act them out every day in their interactions with each other and with students and various other people as well. So they actually get processed and renewed and so on through those individual interactions, and that produces the inflexibility in the provision as well. So, Annika, to finish, do you want to just...
I think I've been talking about this.
Do you want to just pick out one or two, just to...
Well, I think we have to take the last one.
Okay.
Five minutes. Yeah, it's only 5 minutes. We have to, I think we've been talking about this.
Okay.
The challenge and moving boundaries.
Yeah.
This cross-university meetings that John has described to you, that has been what I think the most important thing over this year, that people across university really met each other, they were discussing things, they explored what they were doing and they explored what they wanted to develop together. And I think that was the most important thing during this year. The whole university started to talk about this issue, and,
yeah.
And now you can. I have a good example of one of the heads of the schools. He told me when I was asking, who do you want to send to this group, to be in this group, to talk about violent participation at University of Borås? And he said, we don't need one. We don't need to be in the group. We don't need any more students. We have the students we want. We don't want any more. And so he didn't, and I tried to get him, you know, email, call him, and then I got him at a meeting we had, and I said, Rolf, now you must give me one. And I said, otherwise you will be in the group. So he was in the group.
Yeah, we got him on the group.
And it was very good, because he's changed.
He's transformed. He's now the biggest champion
for
widening participation.
Yes.
He's head of school. So he's
it's
now become
important.
A major force for change.
Very important.
Where he was a major force for actually inflexibility
well,
in the past.
That's a good example when you meet and when you talk and when you discuss things and changing. So this is what we're thinking of doing now, the next phase for the next year.
Yeah.
So we are probably, well, those action projects we think of maybe, John and I have been talking about this junior university that someone have here in England or Scotland, I don't know, that we could put that as an umbrella over different action projects that we are going to go through with. And we want to, this developing and building evidence base, we have a student with us here from Sweden, Frida Edberg, the blonde girl, if you've seen her, very blonde girl.
Yes, yes,
she came last night, remember? Yeah, at the same train as you did. And she has got a summer job from our VC, the rector, Lena.
Mm-hmm.
3 months to take statistics, make a research work for us and the wedding participation, to go out around the schools and ask them about things in this area, and she will make a report for us. So when we have the next meeting in September, she will present this report. This is how it is at this university. This is all the students, so this
mm-hmm.
is what they are doing, and this is very good. And we often do that in Sweden. John says you don't do it so much here in England and Scotland. You don't use the students
nope.
to do work for you. But it's very good, I can really say it's
yeah.
very, very good.
Yeah.
And we will produce a new wider participation plan, action plan, for the next 3 years. Much better than the one we had, that no one looks at, except, you know, it's on a show. And we will make joint research, maybe, projects. We have some, the campus. We'll see if we get some money. And we will have arrange a conference in November 2012. So when you have been on Ireland in July,
that's right.
You've
come to Sweden.
You will come to Sweden at the beginning of November. I will send you the dates. And we'll be real interested. And
yeah.
this includes the you know, that phase here.
Sweden.
Yeah, include Sweden. And we will, at the University of Borås, we'll arrange the next conference. So maybe some of you will be invited to have keynote speakers, maybe. Would be nice.
Can I just
have
say one last thing?
Yeah.
Just one.
I
know, yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Just one, I just want to say one last thing. Okay. I think one of the things what I've learned in all this, because I think in these projects you learn a lot of stuff about yourself, the way you work and so on, and I think we challenge ourselves as well in our practices, was I think what we ended up doing with the group, and the group did the work, we were just there to kind of resource it, really. I think that was our role. We was a resource. Was we started to change the institutional narrative about itself. I'll say that again. We started to change the institutional narrative it had of itself. And I think often institutions don't do that first. They rush in to do a load of actions projects all over the place and talk and write about all kinds of things, and then you look at what happened and you think you can't work out why nothing's changed very much. And it's, I think part of this is actually because you've got to go back to real first base and ask some very challenging and difficult things, and often it's very hard to ask those things, and you don't get institutions which are able and willing to have that process happen before you can actually move on to the real process of change. And I think that's the bit that for us, to its great credit, is beginning to do as an institution. Sorry, Michael.
So this collaboration between two institutions is very important, I think, and I'm very glad that we have this ongoing collaboration with the University of East London now, and it makes new contacts all the time. So this is one example of that.
Well, over time, and I promise we've got 50 minutes before the next one, so just enough time for a couple of questions or observations.
Allowed greater scrutiny. So if you had worked on another university in England,
yeah,
or an economic level in Sweden, would the results have been different?
That's it, yeah. I guess there's a kind of cultural thing going on here. I could ask flat-footed, stupid questions because I didn't know the system. You know, I've been an anthropologist to some extent, I guess. So I could ask the group questions Annika perhaps couldn't, because, you know, she was part of the institution in a way. And I think, you know, we kind of worked that out a bit in our preparation, because we talked a lot about, you know, all these sorts of issues and spent hours on email and on the phone and together where we could, talking over all the sessions and thinking about them in great depth. I mean, we've done justice to some of that in short space of time that we had. But we really spent a long time thinking and analysing those conversations to get under the skin of the institution, because I think that was what we were attempting to do and thought that was necessary.
I think it would be harder if I had contacted another university in Sweden and to make this collaboration. I don't think it would have been the same. But one thing in this collaboration was that my whole group, 25 people, had to speak English because he doesn't speak Swedish. So
don't speak English very well, actually.
That was a big challenge for, especially one, you know, Liana. She wouldn't dare to say anything in English. But in the end, she did.
She did.
Okay.
So that's
just another piece of change.
Okay, I might need to show you appreciation for all of it.